Hi, everybody. Once again, I'm sorry that the video of the real lecture did not take place. So now we're making a new lecture for you, hopefully to explain a few of the slides. So this will be not quite the same, but hopefully give you a help you a little bit when you're studying for the exam. So in lecture two, we talked about chromosomes and genes, how we get variation in genes through recombination and other rearrangements in the genome, and especially about the method of gene mapping. So, you've learned before about the entirety of the genetic information, it's called the genome. And that the DNA of organisms is organized into discrete structures called chromosomes. And so most of this lecture we're talking about diploid organisms, so diploid complement of the genome, in contrast to the haploid complement. This is just a micrograph of the human chromosomes of a male. And so you can find all of the pairs there, so that's a nice task to do in your free time. But just to remind you of some of the kind of concepts of genetics is that when we talk about genes, we're often referring to genes that have a particular function in the for the organism in the cell and for the organismal phenotype. And loci or gene loci is another way of describing regions in the genome that can be identified. They could be producing a particular product, but not necessarily. But at a locus, we're still able to distinguish alleles at the locus that are inherited just with, like the DNA, they're transmitted from generation to generation. So in this diagram here, which just shows a homologous pair of chromosomes, we have three loci that are marked, and then the letters have been used to designate the different alleles, whether they're dominant or recessive, with this capital letter or the lowercase letter, and then the different genotypes can be determined. So a homozygous genotype where the two alleles are the same. So the allele that was inherited by the mother and the allele from the mother and allele inherited from the father. So hopefully you guys all remember that. And of course, not all organisms are diploid. We've already talked about Neurospora last lecture, which alternates between haploidy and diploidy and spends a majority of its life in this haploid form. But there's also different polyploidies that are found in nature and animals and plants especially. And you'll learn more about polyploidy in the next lecture. So why do we have chromosomes? If you just think about the amount of DNA in a single cell, it's quite amazing that there's so much of these nucleotides in one cell, and then just considering that at the whole genome level in a single human, for example, the length of the DNA strand, if we were to stretch it out, is two times the diameter of our whole galaxy. So it's quite a large amount of genetic material. And so this material has to be organized. And that's one of the reasons why it's easier to pass the genetic material from one organism to the next, one generation to the next, because it can be packaged in such a compact structure like the chromosomes. So the DNA is packaged with histone proteins into something called nucleosomes, which is kind of the basic structure of the chromosome. These are about this protein structures have there's five different proteins involved and histone proteins involved in creating the nucleosome, and it allows for coiling about 200 base pairs of DNA into these kind of bead on a string kind of structure. But the coiling doesn't stop there. When the chromosomes are packaged and condensed, the coiling continues and continues so that we find the histone fibers, then get coiled even further and further and further until we recognize this densely packed DNA protein structure that we refer to as the chromosome. It's about half and half DNA and protein. And this representation of the chromosome in the metaphase, so where the two chromatids are visible, is usually what we think of when we think of a chromosome. But all of the genetic information here is included in the chromosome. So this is what you usually think of, this kind of metaphase chromosome with a clear structure with a centromere and telomeres at the tips. So the centromere and the telomere regions of the chromosomes usually do not have very many genes located in them. And the gene-dense regions of the chromosomes are called euchromatin, whereas these gene-poor regions of the chromosome, the centromere and the telomeres, are often referred to as heterochromatin. Doesn't mean that these are not important regions of the DNA, but it's just to distinguish this kind of contrast between the gene content. And of course, the chromosome structure is important because of mitosis. We won't go into that so much, the details, because you should remember that from high school, and hopefully you've reviewed the material in the textbook. But this condensed DNA material into a chromosome basically allows us, or allows the cell, to more easily divide the genetic material into the daughter cells after mitosis. So the duplicated DNA is joined at the centromere into two chromatids, and then they migrate to the midplane of the cell, and then during anaphase, the two chromatids are separated to the two daughter cells after mitosis. So the structure of the chromosomes is really important for ensuring that the genetic material is equally passed to the offspring. But what may not be so obvious to you, and maybe you haven't learned about before, is that the chromosomes, the chromatin, and this kind of association of the genetic material is also evident even when the chromosomes are not fully condensed and when they're not in this metaphase iconic structure that we think of when we think of a chromosome. So the DNA is more relaxed. It's not so coiled in during interphase, but still you can these days we can use fish labeling or some kind of genetic markers to label chromosomes and visualize them even in the interphase stage. And the chromosomes can be identified into these chromosome clouds. And what's interesting about the chromosome clouds is that the genes, of course, that are located in chromosomes are also associated with each other in the clouds. And several insights have been made by studying this organization of the DNA during interphase. And it seems that the small chromosomes are more often in the center of the nucleus, whereas the larger chromosomes are associated towards the edges. And also those gene-rich regions, the chromosomes that have a lot of genes that are producing some important function for the cell, they're more associated towards the center of the nucleus, whereas the gene-poor regions, the heterochromatin, is more associated towards the nuclear membrane. So this kind of positioning of the chromosomes, even when they're not in metaphase, is relevant for gene expression and also epigenetic regulation of gene expression, which you'll learn about more in coming lectures. So, but this structure is quite interesting. You can read more about it in these papers. For example, this nice review paper where it's presented very clearly, and also this figures come from this Bolzer paper. All right. So here's just more about the chromosome clouds. I've already said those things, so we'll move forward. So last time we talked about what were the prerequisites for the genetic material. We know that it has to store information, it can be transferred from generation to generation, can replicate, and it has a impact on the cell's function and also the phenotype. We saw evidence for that in the previous lecture. And in this lecture, we're going to focus more on how there can be variation in the genetic material, so that it has a genetic material has a is a means for evolutionary change. So genetic variation, and where is it coming from? So essentially, mutation and crossing over. We know also you should remember about meiosis from your earlier studies. And meiosis, of course, is one process that brings about some genetic variation to organisms, because here we have replication of the homologous chromosomes. So each partner in the pair has been replicated, consists of this chromosome structure. The sister chromatids joined with the centromere. And these homologous chromosomes during meiosis will line up at the midplane of the cell. And then the two partners in the pair of the vasta chromosomate, they separate to the opposite ends of the cell in the first meiotic division. And this lining up of the homologous chromosomes at the midplane happens in a random manner. And so the separation of the two homologous chromosomes, and in this case, we're just showing one pair of homologous chromosomes, but the association of different homologous chromosomes with each other can vary with each generation. So remember, one partner in this pair of homologous chromosomes has been inherited from the maternal gamete and one from the paternal gamete, but it doesn't mean that in the next generation, all of those homologous chromosomes that were inherited from one parent are then passed on together. They can get mixed up. So in the second meiotic division, the sister chromatids separate again, so that we have four daughter nuclei that are now haploid. And then the two sex cells will come together to produce a new organism. So these random processes of meiosis were already deduced even before we knew about chromosomes with Mendel's experiments and his principles of that are kind of the hallmarks of transmission genetics, that this law of segregation deduced by Mendel is that two of the same kind of alleles are not necessarily they can be separated by this meiotic division. And also the law of independent assortment is that the alleles that influence the phenotype are not dependent on one of the other alleles in the organism. So this kind of random association at the during the first meiotic division is one way that we get a lot of genetic variation. This is also one reason why you might have some features that differ from your parents. You look like a combination of the features that you have inherited from both of your parents. So this is just a reminder of Mendel's experiments with the peas, and one example where we have the heterozygous parents have contributed gametes, half of them with the large W and half with the small W here, that are affecting the phenotype of the seed, whether it's smooth or wrinkled. And of course, those alleles have an effect on the offspring's phenotype, and it's a kind of a random association between the two different gametes that were produced by the parents to give the combination of alleles in the offspring. So here's what I was trying to explain earlier with the lab segregation here, as that is when we have two pairs of homologous chromosomes, say these like those with the large capital letters, could be on one side of the plane or on the other side of the plane, the small letters, or they could be mixed like these. So when they separate to the two poles, we have a expectation of the gametes that will be produced. And this is a both of these are alignments are equally likely, so the overall ratio of gametes is expected to be equal. And we will then expect to see amongst our offspring those with the characteristics coded by these combinations of alleles in an equal association. And this is what is expected when the genes are located on different chromosomes. When the genes are located on the same chromosomes, it's not always true because the association of the genes, of course, they're inherited together, this physical association. But we can nevertheless see some variation in the offspring if something called crossing over has happened. So if we get some recombination of the chromosomes during meiosis. So without if the different alleles are on the same chromosome, we'll have some parental combinations that are expected from meiosis, but then maybe we also see some deviation from that 1-to-1-to-1 ratio, and we can identify something called a recombinant, so a new combination of alleles. So this, of course, is due to crossing over or Dickian Bidenta in meiosis. It happens during the association of the homologous pair of chromosomes in the first meiotic division. They are coming closely in contact at the midplane of the cell, and there can be chromosome breakage and repair. So chiasma are formed between two chromatids of the homologous chromosome pairs here. And with the repair of this kind of chiasma structure, kind of binding together, part of the chromosome from one of the homologous pairs can get transferred to the other. So you see this blue bit is now onto this red chromosome diagram representing the recombination. Just the same kind of image that was shown earlier. So, and this figure from your textbook, you can see the results of the crossing over, also considering two different genes with a wild type allele, which is represented by the plus, or a mutation, A and B, depending on the gene in this particular chromosome pair. So if the two homologous chromosomes come together and there's no crossing over, we expect that in the after the second meiotic division, there'll be four daughter cells with four non-recombinant chromatids. So each one will have a different have its own chromatid, but the two will represent one of the homologous chromosome partners, and the other chromatids will represent the other. And in contrast, when there's crossing over, during the first meiotic division, the chiasma here forms between the sister chromosomes, and there is a transfer genetic material between the two chromatids that have joined at the chiasma. So what happens is then after the second meiotic division, so the repair has taken place here, and then second meiotic division happens to separate those chromatids from each other. We see that there are some chromatids that can be classified as non-recombinant, so they have the same configuration as the parent. In this case, the one with the two mutant alleles and the two wild-type alleles. But there's also these recombinant chromatids that are produced. So this one has a mutant allele together with the wild type at B, whereas this one has the mutant allele at locus A together with the wild type at locus A and the mutant allele at locus B. So hopefully you guys all get that. But so you see that when crossing over happens, we get these kind of new combinations, and our expectation of equal representation of the parental configurations is now different. So the deviation of what we see here compared to the parent is something that is used in experimental studies to quantify crossing over and this concept of recombination. I'm going to take a quick pause and then come back. Okay, so to come back to this idea of recombination, of course, when recombination was discovered, it wasn't the crossing over and the chiasma and the chromosomes was not observed directly. The researchers who, and particularly Thomas Morgan, who was the first to deduce this process of recombination back in 1916, didn't even know about for sure what the genetic material was, but he was studying the phenotypes of fruit flies and made a lot of insights by examining the inheritance of the different mutations that naturally occurred in the very large populations of fruit flies that he studied. So, Thomas Morgan then had the kind of luck to be studying these organisms that were easy to maintain in very large populations in the laboratory, and also luck to be able to use these kind of mutants that were naturally occurring yet easily observed in living individuals. So, in this particular example of one of the crosses that he did, he used females that have white eyes. The wild type of the fruit fly, of course, is to have a red eye, and the white is a mutant. And he also used mutant flies with very miniature wings here. So here's a male with a wild type red eye, but a miniature wing. So the experimental cross that he's is diagrammed with this kind of notation, where we have the white mutation for the eye. The other gene here is the wing. It's the wild type. The females have normal wings, whereas the male has the wild type eye and the miniature mutant wing. Of course, it has the Y chromosome, so it does isn't balanced by other the homologous chromosome here. So, Morgan did these crosses, and then also crossed the F1 generation, so the first hybrid generation. And what he found was that this kind of equal expectation of the parental phenotype was not evident in the F2 generation. So actually, he didn't find equal numbers of white-eyed flies with long wings and red-eyed flies with short wings. What he found was the kind of maternal parental type, so this white-eyed normal wing fly, and then also red eyes and miniature wings. But then he also found these weird combinations that weren't exhibited by the parents, so the red eyes and the normal wings, so basically wild type flies, and double mutants, the white eyes and the miniature wings. So using these large numbers of crosses, Thomas Morgan was able to get a good statistical sample and estimate the percentage of individuals that had the parental combinations, so this parental allele, and also the percentage that had the new mixtures of alleles in his experiment. So 66.5 had the parental combination, and 33.5 had the recombinant. So this deviation from the expectation allowed him to deduce that the genes were linked together, and that the some mixture of the alleles happens, and to the extent of how frequently these mixtures can happen. So essentially, the first observations of recombination, and he went on further to study other kinds of mutants and their association on the same chromosome. It's another example with the white eye, again, allele and eye gene that codes for the size of the males, so diminutive males. And other experiments have similar kinds of deviations from the one-to-one expectations. And what Morgan recognized is that the frequency of these recombinant types out of his observation. So in this case, there were 31 recombinants out of 1,000, so 3.1%, gave him a way to estimate how much recombination has been taking place. So this is, of course, logical when you think about that the distance, also the It also could connect this kind of recombination frequency to distance between the genes. So if we think about the crossing over process that we looked at earlier, crossing over is well, it's not as likely to be to occur if the genes are very, very closely physically located on the same chromosome, just because there's not enough space for the chiasma to form and for the recombination event to take place. And so when they're extremely distant from each other, we don't observe the recombination. So the he used the statistical difference from the expectation of this 1-to-1 transmission of the parental phenotype combination to estimate this frequency of recombination, and went on further to deduce that this frequency of recombination also could be used to predict the distances between the different genes on the same chromosome. So, in after his repeated experiments with Drosophila, not just these two, but many, many, many experiments, he came to the conclusion of this association with recombination and distance. And so the kind of unit of measure for the distance between genes is named in his honor, this idea of a centimorgan, which is about 1% of recombination between different loci. And this unit, mapping unit, the centimorgan, is still used, of course, today in honor of his observations and insight into recombination. And this work paved the way for something called genetic mapping, which is commonly used, especially in plant breeding, when the focus is on producing a phenotype, or also other animal breeding, any kind of breeding, when the focus is on phenotype, deciding where when to cross particular parental types in order to create new combinations of phenotypes. So genes that affect the phenotype, in this case we see an example from corn. So we have phenotypes about the leaves, about the corn kernels, about the shape of the corn cob, and also their kind of makeup of the kernel, how much starch is there, and so on. These kind of maps have been made to link particular regions of chromosomes that produce a phenotype and the distance they are to some other gene that produces a different phenotype, so that crosses can be generated to create new combinations of phenotypes in the well, like a more desired outcome for the crop. So this mapping unit, which can be deduced by looking at the phenotypes of organisms, examining how much recombination or new associations of alleles takes place, is very useful. And one things that have been are kind of with further experimentation has been understood is that this difference between the very gene-rich regions and the gene-poor regions of the chromosomes. So the heterochromatin around the centromere, telomeres, has very little recombination The euchromatin region displays more recombination. And so, actually, by looking only at this recombination as a unit of distance, we might overestimate the actual physical size of the DNA strand in the euchromatin regions compared to the heterochromatin. So it's not like a literal mapping of counting how many nucleotides there are between particular genes, but how much exchange happens between these regions of the chromosomes. And actually, because of the sex chromosomes, we see that there's more recombination that happens in women compared to men, which have the XY, because there's more recombination that happens between the homologous X chromosomes. So the genetic map for females is longer in a way, but it's just a relative distance here. Okay. So hopefully you can now that you understand a little bit more about recombination, you can imagine that sometimes we don't notice or we don't see that recombination has occurred when we're only focusing on the phenotype. And so this is one example of this kind of unobserved recombination. It doesn't mean that there hasn't been exchange between the chromatids, but so if there's been a chiasma at this location, and we're focused on the phenotypes affected by locus A and locus B, we can see that there's been a recombination of the chromosome structure here, but it doesn't affect the association of these two loci and their alleles at those two loci. So it essentially, for someone experimenter looking only at phenotypes, we don't notice any difference from the parental. So also they can the crossing over can, if there's multiple crossing over events, depending on where they occur, they can either cancel each other out, or maybe they're in this region that is not, again, affecting the two loci of interest that we're studying. So it's just a matter of what you're looking at when you're doing the experiments. So we can make these nice diagrams where we draw the chromosomes, but in reality, we're looking at phenotypes of organisms that are affected by gene A and gene B here. So we may not see any effect. Nevertheless, we can make use our understanding of crossing over and these possible double recombinants. If we add a third locus that could be somewhere else in the genome, focus on more than just A and B, we can then maybe try to resolve these double crossing overs. So here we've added locus C, and if it exists somewhere here, then we'll find some recombinant associations of alleles affecting the phenotype. So this is what's done in the genetic mapping. So you saw those at the picture with the corn map. There were lots of different genes marked on the chromosomes, and so the to really get a finer understanding of the associations, get more precision, not just this relative distance between two genes. We can add more and more genes, more and more phenotypes to kind of narrow down the distance between them. And this is just an example of a kind of three-way cross where we're looking at three different phenotypes in corn. We have three different genes here: lazy, glossy, and sugary. And the normal wild type is represented by these capital capitalized abbreviations for lazy, glossy, and sugary. And then the lazy, glossy, and sugary mutant phenotypes are the lowercase ones here. These are the parental phenotypes that are crossed together. The researchers then look for recombinants of the different phenotype associations. So if we just get corn plants that are only lazy, can count those up. The ones that are only glossy are the ones that are only sugary, but otherwise have the wild type characteristics. Count them up, and then we can find the ones with double two mutants, so lazy and glossy, lazy and sugary, and then glossy and sugary, and then all three mutants. And just like Morgan did with counting up what kind of offspring were produced by these cross, the number of parental associations, single recombinants, and double recombinants can be deduced. So the ones with double recombination are going to be much more rare compared to those that have only a single recombination event. And of course, the parental phenotype associations are going to be the most common. And so in this particular cross, there's three possibilities for the associations of the genes in the chromosomes. It could be from left to right here. First the lazy gene, the glossy gene, and the sugary gene. Or it could be that it's lazy sugary in the middle, and then glossy. Or it could be that lazy is in the middle, so we have glossy and sugary. And so the researchers can then have an expectation for each of these possibilities, possible orientations of the three genes along the chromosomes. Then they have a prediction of what the recombinants should be, and that these double recombinants will again be the rarest ones. So using these expectations, the researchers can go back, look at the numbers that were found. So the double gloss, double recombinants have just a sugary, or they sugary. Sorry, the sugary phenotype or the lazy glossy phenotype here. And because of that, it means that sugary locus has to be in the middle of these two to get the sugary recombinant here. So otherwise, we have lazy and glossy wild type, but the sugary mutation. And then here we have the lazy and glossy mutations, but the sugary wild type. And I know these phenotypes of corn are kind of strange with these strange names, but so I tried to give you some pictures of what they look like. So the glossy is referring to the glossy color of the corn kernels. Sugary seeds are exactly what that implies, that the seed has much more sugar rather than starch. And so those sugary seeds are really wrinkly looking and kind of collapsed rather than rounded. And then this lazy phenotype is a kind of growth of the stalk of the corn plant. It falls over onto its side. It doesn't grow straight up from the ground. So this is just one example, and this is also explained in your textbook about how the researchers can use these phenotypes to deduce the association or the location of the genes of some new gene on the chromosome. Yeah, so for humans, of course, we don't cross humans. It's ethical to cross them, and we also can are not producing enough offspring to really get a good statistical estimate on these different phenotype associations. And so, nevertheless, the genetic mapping is still done, especially for genetic diseases that are relatively rare in human populations. But using the larger population sizes and the frequencies of these different genetic diseases, there's been some progress in making a genetic map of where these genes are located, and also different methods now for sequencing have allowed us to do more kinds of genetic mapping. So we now can sequence the DNA directly, relatively easily, and in large quantities, and looking at small mutations in the genome and following these individual mutations, these mutations are just a single base change called a single nucleotide polymorphism, and they can be used to recognize when how much recombination has occurred. And the SNP mutations are used in what's called association tests or genome-wide association studies or GWAS. And these are quite often done, and so that the a large population of individuals that have, for example, a disease could be genotyped at particular SNPs, and then also a large population of individuals that are healthier that can serve as controls are also genotyped, and then the differences in the frequencies of particular allele associations can then be mapped. And this method is quite common in medical studies, and also quite common for looking at associations between multiple genes that can influence a particular phenotype. So many of our most prevalent diseases are not the result of a single gene, but many genes. And so this GWAS method allows us to pick out regions of the genome that have a strong statistical association with a particular disease case. It also can be used not only in medicine, but also for like ecological questions. And this is just one example of a GWAS that's done for looking at loci associated with the timing of the bud set in aspen trees. So, of course, with the climate change, the plants respond, changing their bud set timing. So, like when the leaves are then opening up on the trees in response to the changing climate. And using the same kind of idea of genotyping lots of different trees with different kinds of phenotypes, timing of their bud set, a particular locus could be identified that has a strong association with this feature. All right. So why does the variation exist in the first place? We talked about different ways of getting the variation, either through inheritance of kind of this random inheritance of particular alleles from the parental generation to recombination between those parental alleles. But why is it even there? And of course, ultimately, variation is due to mutation in the genome, but there's a lot of cellular repair mechanisms to repair mutational changes. And this is a normal part of the functioning of the cell. And If the repair doesn't result in a negative consequence for the organism, of course it can be perpetuated. And it is kind of nicely diagrammed in this figure from your textbook, where here a mutation has changed one of the bases in this double-stranded DNA here, so that the G and T are no longer binding to each other, so they're not complementary. And so this bulge in the double helix makes it a target for the mismatch repair machinery. And of course, either one of the strands can be chosen to be repaired. We can repair this T to match the G, or we could repair this G to match the T. So that's what's diagrammed in these two paths here, that the part of the DNA sequence is then cut away from the helix, and then the enzymes will repair the break by using what's remaining here in the complementary strand as a guide, as a template. So it will build new DNA, and it will add a C here to match the G and make a nice, nicely complementary double helix structure. If this strand is chosen for the repair, this part will be excised, and again, similar, the gap is refilled, and now there's going to be an A added at this position. So this is the origin of a new SNP in the genome through the normal mismatch repair. And similarly, during recombination, remember during when the chiasmer formed, there's a breakage of the DNA strands and then repair of those DNA strands, which can be repaired in a recombinant fashion. And it's a similar kind of mechanism for repairing mismatches, but using that alternate strand as the template for the repair, for creating new DNA. So in this case, we have a double-stranded break of our homologous chromosome pair. So we have two partners here in their homologous chromosome, the blue one and the pink one. There's been a double-stranded break in the blue one when the chiasma is formed. And depending on there's different possibilities for repairing this double-stranded break. So kind of the chromatids of the neighboring homologous partner will then open up a little bit, and the new strand is using it as a template for creating new DNA sequences. If it does so in such a way that it's only looking using one of those two chromatids as the template, as in this case here, it can just be temporarily kind exposed to the DNA in the homologous chromosome and use it as a template. Then it's again excised from this loop and built up, extended with the remaining part of the double-stranded break, and a kind of complementary strand is then built against it. So this would yield a kind of non-recombinant chromosome, homologous chromosome pair. But what happens during the crossover is that not only is the new strand built off of one chromatid, but there's also new, the double-stranded break is repaired off of the other chromatid. So we have this sort of mixture of repair going on here in two different directions of the antiparallel DNA. And this sort of complex arrangement of the multiple repair mechanism leads to this sort of crossing of the two different chromatids. And then depending on how these crosses are resolved, whether they're broken in one direction or the other direction, we can get what's called the crossover and the recombinant genotypes. So these crossing points of the two different chromatids are called holiday junctions, and there are the point where this kind of mistake is made in the repair mechanism. So we have sort of a complex repair going on here with multiple strands being involved. Yep. All right. The other kind of variation in the genome, not only are these single nucleotide changes and large crossing over or recombination events, but there can also be smaller duplications of the chromosome during meiotic replication. So these regions of the chromosome could be duplicated just by a sort of mistake in the replication machinery. So one part is built along the new template, a new DNA strand is made, but then it makes a mistake and kind of repeats its work and can duplicate this region. Another thing, it could also possibly skip over some part of the template and end up in a deletion. So these kind of copy number variants are also common in the genome, and sometimes they're quite large, sometimes they can be quite small, depending on where these duplications or deletions occur. They can be quite harmful, but some of them do not have a significant effect on the organism or the cell. One particular kind of marker or locus where this happens a lot are regions called STRs, or simple tandem repeats. These are also called microsatellites. And these are regions where there could be just a small, very small repeated region, like a GTC repeat over and over and over again in the genome. And you can imagine that the polymerase, when it's building a new strand, complementary to the strand, it can sometimes lose its place, lose count of where it has started to make to replicate, and end up in repeating some regions or cutting some regions out. So these kinds of copy number variants are quite common in the genome, and actually they've been used as genetic markers, not only in genetic mapping, but also in population genetics. So if you're interested in that, you can learn more about it in other courses. So the try to make this go away a little bit. One common copy number variant is when it has been beneficial in for organisms, is usually when it has involved copy of an entire gene, a gene that has an important function for the organism. And one example of this is the amylase gene, which has been copied in our own genome and other mammal genomes. Amylase is an enzyme that helps organism break down starches, and it's been important for digestion of food. So it gives a benefit to the organism to have this gene, allows them to eat and digest starch. And if you look at the evolutionary history of this gene and the numbers of copies of this gene and different mammalian groups, you can see that in some groups there's quite many copies of the human, there's quite many copies of the amylase gene. Each block here represents an amylase gene in the genome. Other primates also have multiple copies, but then some rodents are eating more starchy seeds and nuts also have multiple copies. And you can see that it's also interesting that some organisms, like the domestic dog, has many copies of the amylase gene, probably because its association with humans and eating also scraps of food from the human diet, whereas closest relatives, like the wolves, only have one copy of the amylase genes because they have mainly a protein diet. So copy number variants are another way that we get variation in the genome. And these can be both harmful and beneficial. You're going to talk more about this, I think, in the next lecture. So just to wrap up, we talked about importance of chromosome structure, packaging the DNA into discrete unit, and also that its DNA is also of chromosomes are very much associated, even when they're in an unpacked state in the chromosome clouds. We learned why recombination is important and where genetic variation comes from. You can get different, not only different alleles from your parents, can inherit them differently, but you can also get these new gene combinations because of recombination during meiosis. We learned about gene mapping. It's a way to not only describe the recombination, but also understand the distances between genes in the genome. So this kind of physical location of the genes, and also how the genes are affecting the phenotype, how specific mutations are having an effect on the organisms. We talked a little bit about sequence variations, SNPs, and copy number variants, and how the normal repair structures of the cells are important for or they have an influence on how we observe this variation in the genome. There was one homework. This was optional, and I just remind you that you can should be doing this Kertaustentti in Moodle. It's going to be open for the majority of the lecture time, but go ahead and try to do it. And if you've need to read the chapters, review the material from chapters 1 through 3 before you attempt the Kertaustentti. All right. Sorry once again for the video, and hopefully things will go better with the next courses. All right. I'll end this here.